Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 11 of Hold That Thought with Kevin Stamper. Hold That Thought is a podcast dedicated to the creative side of the music business. We love discovering what it takes and where the motivation comes from when creating that masterpiece. The idea behind this series is to inform and educate our listeners, and also, more importantly, learn the business as we each grow daily together. My next guest, Kevin Stamper, is currently the lead pastor of Restoration Church, which is a new and unique church from Trinity, Florida. He has been a pastor of music and arts at multiple churches all over the country. He has also toured as a musician. I met Kevin almost a year ago at Toastmasters. He has mentored me on multiple presentations and has just recently won a contest that will take him to the finals in Vancouver, Canada this August. Warning, his speeches are powerful and will lead you to stop and think. In this episode, we rapped about lyres made from turtle shells, water organs, hymns, primates making music, metaphysics within music, and the connection between music and nature. Kevin and I plan on doing multiple episodes. This will be called the Continuous Church Music Series. If you have a specific topic or area of discussion you would like to hear that relates to church music, send us your comments at cjsevents1@gmail.com. If you enjoy this episode or any other episodes of Hold That Thought, simply like and subscribe on iTunes or Podomatic. I hope you guys enjoy episode 11 with Kevin Stamper. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 11 of Hold That Thought with Kevin Stamper. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, good to be here.
Today, can you hear me okay? Mm-hmm. Everything good?
Yeah.
Today, we're going to talk about church music, and I picked out two topics. Water organs, which is the oldest known keyboard and played a huge role in church music and hymns. Mm. So one of the things I wanted to start it off with, and I want to paint the picture. So you're standing under a 20-foot high water organ. And this organ was built next to a massive ark and it sits right next to this waterfall that pounds into this water organ. And it's from the 3rd century, and you're just standing there and you're in complete awe. And it's in Tivoli at the time, which is now Italy. So this organ is the Cadillac of water organs, and it's designed to play on its own. It auto plays up to 3 songs without doing anything, just from the waterfall. It auto plays in the 3 song. It also has a keyboard for manual play. So even in the 3rd century BC, music was integrated into our daily lives. What if the public water organ made a comeback? Do you think the sounds could help ease some of the current tension that's going on right now?
Man, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it? That'd be crazy if there was still a water organ happening. Yeah, I think there's, that'd be interesting to watch that happen. I love the intricacy there of nature playing into music, right? Like, that's where music came from. It came from nature. That's where it still comes from. In fact, I remember one of my favorite artists growing up was Dave Matthews. And so I went to a lot of shows of his, and I remember one time somebody was asking him, where do you come up with songs? Where do you come up with ideas for songs? And he said, actually, usually like I just hear nature. Like I hear when I'm riding on a train, I hear this clicks, you know, and these clacks, and I hear these noises. And sometimes when I'm sitting outside, I'll hear these noises that nature is making. And it kind of just makes this, this sound that makes this, you know, this music in my head. And you see the same thing there with the water organ, right? How cool would that be if nature and music were really that integrated? You know, that's such an interesting concept.
And I really think they are that mm-hmm. integrated. For example, they built these water organs in conservatories and they put them outside in nature. So, and that was one of the questions I had crafted, because the more I pondered the water organ, the more I really thought, okay, this instrument is completely connected with the earth. But is it connected in a spiritual way where they're keeping the instrument outside so that people can hear the music outside spiritually? Or is it connected on a different level where the music that is being played is going back to reflect nature? For example, my mom was dead set on, we had a Florida room in our house, and my mom was dead set that she would come in and every morning she played her classical music for her plants. And then towards the day, each time of the day, she played different styles of music for her plants. And there was a connection for her. And when a certain plant wasn't doing well that was on the front porch, she would bring it to the back porch to get the music. So
which does make sense if you think about it. There's never been, so if we look at societies, if we look at culture, there has never been a society, no matter how far back we go, there's never been a society that doesn't have really two things. One, usually a form of religion, some form of religion. Doesn't mean that it's all based on the God of the Bible. Doesn't mean that it's all based on any other God specifically. But they always have a religion. And the other thing they always have is music. There's always been music. Every society we've ever come across has had music. In fact, even sometimes before they knew how to communicate with one another in any other way, they had music. They had a way that they could beat on a skin that made sound like a drum, or they had a way that they could blow into a certain reed that sounded like something. Since the beginning of time, we've had music almost before we've had even words that go with that music.
Well, when I was conducting my research, I'd never realized how much is intertwined with church music. Mm-hmm. And so what you just elaborated on, religion and the music, and we could probably throw nature into it, because one of the lyres, the oldest instrument was originally made out of a turtle shell.
Oh, really? I didn't know.
Yes. I'm researching. I'm going, okay, you take a turtle shell and then you put cross strings. Mm-hmm. And that was how the lyre was made. And so the more you research, the more we're finding these connections into nature, whether it be a turtle shell or animal skin for a drum. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's very common. But so let's get back onto the water organ. Mm-hmm. And one of the other things I came across is this statement really struck me as odd. And I'll add the source in our links. Mm-hmm. So when you go back, you can see, check out the source. The water organ is the oldest keyboard known to man or ape. Oh, wow. And it was specifically worded man or ape. What are your thoughts on correlating apes and music? Do you think they were, how do you feel about that? You think they use music to get by?
You know, I don't know. I don't know that they use music, but you do think of what we hear as music being something that's constant, again, throughout nature. So I don't know. I've never thought of apes or specifically like any primates being involved in that. definitely have thought of, I mean, when you think of birds and you think of songbirds and you think of impressionist birds and these ways that they know how to make music naturally. It's just something that happens and they have patterns and they have rhythms to the way they do it. It's not just tonal. It's not just pitches that they put out there, right?
Yeah.
There's rhythm and there's this flow to it. There's actually like this dialogue that's happening through music with birds and with different animals. So I never thought of it specifically as primates, but it definitely, I don't know that it's immune from that either. I mean, you've seen with certain animals how they have almost a music to the way they speak. Dolphins do the same thing. Whales do the same thing. There's a lot of animals that know how to communicate, and what we would hear is music. And the way that they're communicating, it's just simply their language, you know?
Last time we were at the zoo, there were a couple monkeys, and one was a female that just came in. And I forget where it came in, and this monkey had this awesome call. I couldn't even do it if I knew it. It just wouldn't sound right over the microphone. But the sounds and the communication that were coming out, and that's why I found the question on primates so intriguing, yeah. Or the statement on there, because they're so vocal when communicating that maybe they did share some type of music.
Yeah, it's very possible. Yeah.
It's very possible. Here's some of the cool facts that I found out about water organs. I'm going to read some of these facts, and then we're going to revisit them and kind of analyze them. Written records of what organs, water organs, are found in texts dating back to the 3rd century. The second cool fact, some ancient models use solar heat to transfer water from one closed tank to another. The third fact, in the Renaissance period, water organs were regarded as magical and metaphysical instruments by certain scientific and religious groups. And then the fourth really interesting fact is water organs played by hydraulic automation were placed in gardens and conservatories. So let's look at these and analyze them a little bit. Some ancient models use solar heat to transfer water from one closed tank to another in the 3rd century BC. Why do we not have solar panels right now on every single house? What happened along the way?
Man, that's amazing. I don't know. That's a great question. Yeah, the Enlightenment changed a lot of things. And so it sounds like right around the Enlightenment, when that happened, the Enlightenment did change how we understood nature. And actually, we started to pull ourselves away from nature. This is where some of the scientific breakthroughs also started to divert us from religion, and science kind of took their separate paths, right? So it's interesting because there could have been maybe some amazing overlap, but we also see that that's the time where kind of science said, you know, we believe that maybe we're explaining some things about God, and religion said, no, you can't explain God. Like, stop trying, stop doing that. And the two should be more synonymous. I believe personally, and that there is a strong correlation between science and God. I don't think that one disproves the other or one is mutually exclusive. More often than not, most of science I look at, I'm going, man, that explains how God put this together. But it still points, for me, to an intelligent designer and a God who has to be somewhere involved in this for any of this to happen. Because there's still got to be something behind this story, right? We still have to have an origin story. We still have to have somebody that design and delicately put together some of the science that we're seeing, because this science is so over the top, right?
Oh, it's well advanced. We're talking 3rd century yeah. BC. I don't know if you, I don't have a timeline in front of me, but if you had, you look from the 3rd century BC to, I don't know, the modern days, and there would be another huge gap of where we just fell scientifically and technology, and it just dropped, and it went, because the modern day plumbing in 3rd century BC and able to connect solar energy and opening doors and running instruments and having waterfalls running instruments and intertwining and connecting all this, and then it just disappears.
Yeah.
And then we just go a whole nother route.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, you're looking at, again, in the Enlightenment, we start to see the beginnings of modern civilization, right? So people start to urbanize a little bit. They start to come around. Again, books are starting to come out. There's things that are starting to happen where information's starting to become centralized again. And so people are moving to these urban areas. So probably a waterfall is not super practical for people trying to urbanize, probably trying to set up these more modern civilizations. Waterfalls, external stuff, things we can't control a little bit, which is what nature is, right? Something we can't control. That's hard to deal with when you're used to enlightenment. Enlightenment actually took us into a place where we learned how to control things. And we were better at controlling things. And so we liked to be in control. We were now in control of the creation. We could tell creation what to do. We could tell, you know, nature how to act sometimes. And when nature didn't cooperate with us, we ran away from it. And we went our own way. And so that's probably what happened, is it probably was not a practical situation anymore.
I'm wondering just at what point is that when the government was was slowly getting formed, and you're right, as people got urbanized, there was more rules. Thinking maybe stopped along the way at some period. I didn't do a thorough research into, you know, the solar power. That I did read that the Arabs were huge inventors, and they were able to make the instruments run off both solar and water. So I imagine those instruments were outdoors for people to hear and listen to, and that's amazing, because there's very few places you can go outside and you can walk through Hammock Park or walk through a park and you can hear the sounds of nature. There's very few places you can actually go and hear a built in, something that's just run by nature. Maybe that's something we can get someone to create for us.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Put right in front of your church. I think that would be awesome.
That'd be awesome. Talking about those turtle shell lighters, man, that'd be killer.
That would be cool. So in the Renaissance period, water organs were regarded as magical and metaphysical instruments by certain scientific and religious groups. Do you feel that the music was new and fresh, and that it really helped connect people spiritually? So it was regarded as metaphysical. Do you think it was regarded by this religious and scientific groups because the music was new and people weren't used to it?
Probably in the Enlightenment, that's a big time for that. I do think the metaphysical world and like the metaphysical word there, even, it's a big word, but there's a lot of ramifications for all of music in the metaphysical. Like, metaphysical was never meant to be something that, we use it now and it sounds like this really trendy word, but at the time, you know, what we understand about that is that there are pieces of our physical being and the tangible that also deal with things that are intangible. There's things that are both, and we have to learn how they intersect. Music in general is always a metaphysical situation, right? It's something tangible, something like we can kind of understand. We get to put grips on it. We get to understand it, grasp pieces of it, but it still is something that's bigger than us. We can't fully explain it, right? I can't fully explain music to you. I can't fully give you. In fact, I in college, I took theory classes for a while. And I remember at one point I was in a theory class and I had a professor who was very frustrated with me because I would usually get things right, but I just kind of learned my own way around theory, music theory. And he got very frustrated about it. And he finally came to me and he said, "You keep reminding me that music is in fact a theory. We don't have a fact. It's not music facts. That's not a real class, right? What we learn is we learn music theory, because at the end of the day, all we know is that it's a theory. We can put some guide rails on it. We can try to understand it the best we can, but we can't fully pin this thing down called music and say we've got it all figured out.
So with the theory aspect of it, what was the point that you couldn't grasp? Was it the point that of the feeling that comes in when you're overwhelmed with a song?
Yeah, I think that's a big thing, right? Like, is that there's something.
Because how do you explain that? Because certain songs hit you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you explain the impact music has? How do I explain to you even, have you heard this song? It sounds like that's really difficult to put into words, right?
Yeah.
And so, but the same thing, like you're saying, it's very difficult for me to explain to somebody who is deaf what a drum sounds like. It's very difficult for me to explain to somebody who is deaf, you know, what a guitar sounds like versus what a piano sounds like or what a violin sounds like. It's very difficult to make those distinctions with words, right? You just have to hear them. You have to understand them by hearing them. And it's one of those things that makes it a metaphysical situation. So when we see in the Enlightenment, even in church music, I mean, and we've talked about this before, but the metaphysical side of music was taken out in the Enlightenment a little bit. We kind of took some of this away. Music itself, and this is why the church has done music for so long, since dating back before the
it goes and goes. Yeah. And that's why we're going to have multiple episodes.
Yeah. Yeah.
On this, because there's so much to cover, and it's so intriguing.
Yeah, yeah. And they understood the idea of the metaphysical side of it. And there was a piece where it was, again, you have in your brain, you have those three parts of your brain that work together in tandem. So we usually just look at two sides of the brain. We look at the left side and the right side of the brain. That's what we talk about in America, that you have a creative side. You have your right side. It's a little bit more creative, a little bit more free flowing, a little bit more artistic. You have the left side, which the left side is going to be your facts and your figures. And it's going to handle some things that are more concrete, right? So if you ever do a survey on like how much of your brain is which side, for me, I think my brain is like 80% the creative side. So like 20% of my brain balances my checkbook, which isn't really great, right? So I like that physical side is a different side.
I don't want to take this test, folks.
Yeah, yeah, right. And so you have these two sides, but there's a third piece to the brain that we don't talk about frequently. And that third piece is called the amygdala. And it's actually in the front cortex of the brain. And it sits in a place where it really deals with your emotions and your feelings. It has a lot to do with your memories and the way that you feel in your memories and the things that kind of come to mind, the things that evoke emotion. That's what that is. Because in the Enlightenment, see, we moved that out of the brain. We've called it our heart. We put all of our feelings in our heart, which is fine. But remember, your heart really doesn't feel anything. Your heart pumps blood.
Yeah.
That's all it does at the end of the day. But we've moved it to our heart. We relegated into our heart all of our emotions. But our brain still is really where the chemical reactions happen that cause emotion. It all happens in the brain, right? So we have this factual side, we have this creative side, and then we have this emotional response all within the brain. And music is one of the few places where all three of those things come together, where you can have a factual or a more concrete part of what you're singing or what you're saying. It's something where you can sing about something that's really dear to your heart, something that matters to you. It's why you can sing about politics, or you can sing about religion, or you can sing about, you know, about somebody you love. All those feelings or all those thoughts are still concrete thoughts. There's still things going on in that are powerful. Then you're seeing it through a creative lens. So the other part of your brain is working, saying, here's a creative outlet for this. And then that front part of your brain is
your prefrontal cortex, correct? Yes.
Yeah, that thing's feeling the emotion of what's happening.
And that is the last area of the brain to deteriorate.
Yes. Yeah.
So if you ever had Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or a serious mental disease, mm-hmm. you are still, that area of the brain is one of the very last to deteriorate, and you can still recall mm-hmm. and you can still capture the feelings of songs that you heard 30, 40 years prior.
Yes.
Which it blows my mind.
It's amazing. I mean, you can think about it. Just the other day, I was in Nashville. I'm walking through downtown Nashville, and of course, every bar's got a band, and they're all playing their stuff, and they're right in the windows, you know. And I'm walking past. I went to a country bar for a little bit. I'm listening to this band play. They're not as country as they used to be in Nashville. Let's not kid ourselves. But like the country band I listened to was playing like Uptown Funk at one point. I was like, so it was worth a shot. But I'm walking down the street.
That's no new country. What a twist. Right.
And so I'm walking down the street and I hear another band. They're playing Rage Against the Machine, right? And they're playing Killing in the Name Of. And it's one of my favorite songs. I love the song. So I'm like, I stop and I'm listening to them playing Rage Against the Machine. And as I stop and I'm listening to them play the song, and they're killing it. This band is doing a great job with the song. I'm listening to it. I'm like, I'm like in it. Like I'm taken back to like middle school when this was my jam and you know, whatever. And as I'm standing there listening to these guys, I look around me at the end of the song and suddenly the entire sidewalk is stopped with people about my age, people about 30 to 35, all standing there. And for some reason, that age group was what stopped on the street at that moment, because for some reason that song resonated with that age group at that time, right? And we will still probably in 30 years, if we were still walking through Nashville, I guarantee if they played that song in 30 years, 60, the same, 65 same group would be stopping, going, like, this song connects in some weird way to my childhood, to the way that time I remember lapse. Growing up. It just all sticks with you. It's exactly what music can do.
It's that feeling that it leaves you with. There's always that. What I find is odd is the guilty pleasure one.
Yeah, right.
And you don't want to tell anyone about, right. You know, okay, Huey Lewis in the news. And next thing you know, you're getting down in the living room and you're like, why am I doing this? Well, I don't like Huey Lewis in the news, but I got the feeling.
That's right, exactly.
And it's there. It overcomes you and you're like, okay,
yeah.
I love this song.
Exactly. And that's what music can do. And that's why the church... and again, I think it's been so synonymous with the church for so long, because music, that's what, there's the power of that within the church to use music and to have these experiences that are creative, but also they speak truth. They speak the theology you believe. They speak the doctrine that you believe. And they also can have an emotional response to them when you remember those songs. I can tell you people right now that, they're in their 70s, 80 years old, and I can tell you they will still be able to tell me in a church service where they were when they changed their life, when they decided to like give their life to Jesus or follow Jesus for the rest of their life. They can tell you the song that was playing at that moment, and they can tell you where they were. And because when they hear that song today, they can still tell me, I remember this song. I remember where I was. I remember what it smelled like. I remember the room I was in. I remember the people I went down to an altar with and prayed with, whatever. All those things converge because of that music. That music sticks with them that long, and they can still tell me every time they hear that song exactly how they felt in that moment. So it has all of those things put together, which is a rare thing, and only really music does that.
That's really interesting, because you hear people talk about major events, JFK being assassinated, certain presidents taken over, certain 9/11, certain situations, and people are instantly able to recall every single aspect and detail of where they were and what happened. But very few times do people recall memories like that. With certain songs they do, like what we were just talking about, but I've never heard people get really descriptive into where they were, what they did, what was happening, remembering the smell of the time. When you're writing, what's your creative approach when you're writing music for the church? Are you handling all the writing for the church?
I don't handle all of it. I used to write a lot more music. There was a time where I toured and I was doing a lot more of that. And, you know, music shifted considerably in the church these days. But I do think that, you know, when you're writing or when you're even looking for music in the church, there are a few things you're looking for. I mean, one of the things for me, and this is just the way that we wire our church and the way that we see things, but we actually spend a lot more time listening to music that's not Christian music or not worship music. And that's not to say that... you know, we should go too far with that. But we do listen to other music, mostly because we know that people are coming into our church that don't go to church. And so we want to make sure that the music kind of sounds like something they would listen to on their own, right? Where if we get into the Christian bubble, we get into the music that we only listen to, then we don't know if it sounds like something that some other people are looking for. Amazing Grace, songs like, I mean, Amazing Grace is actually a great example of it. Many songs that were hymns were written to secular songs. They were written to bar songs. And they would just put these Christian lyrics in there, right? So they'd change these lyrics to be something that fit what the church was trying to say. But most of the time, people would be walking through, hear these songs, and be like, oh, I know that song. They'd wander over to a piano player who's playing this song that they've heard in the bar. And all of a sudden, they're singing different words. but it hooked people in, it drew people in, and that's actually where many of our hymns got their melodies, were from bar songs.
Well, on my hymn research, this is something that really took a hold of me, is that I found that they change over time, which is really odd, because if you're a music lover, a music fan, you get used to a certain song or hymn, and you know the lyrics and you know what it's going to do. But through as religion progressed and church music went from traditional to contemporary, the hymns changed. And they geared the hymns towards the time, and they changed the lyrics and made everything. Could you imagine, like, 30 years from now, if we change Brown Eye Girl or something like that? I mean, music does change like that, but it just strikes me odd. Do you feel that people would classify your congregation by your music?
A lot of churches are classified by their music. And as far as just like, is this a more modern church? Is this a more traditional church? Is this, what kind of church is this? Based on the music matters a lot in churches. And so people are really paying attention to that. And when they come in, the type of music they hear kind of does qualify what kind of church you are. If we're still doing a piano and organ and we have a choir, a lot of times people are like, this is a very traditional church. You know, we're still singing hymns, or we still, but if we have, you know, if you have a drummer and you have a, you know, the bass player, guitarist, all that stuff, then you're going, okay, this is a little bit more modern. There's something else going on here. It's a little bit newer. The type of church I'm a part of, we're much more contemporary or modern in that approach, but it does qualify that. And I think the hymns that have changed, they have changed. They've changed little bits here and there. Some of what's changed, and this is really going to sound weird, but is they've actually gotten more drab as they've gone over the years. So some of the hymns that are played today by piano and organ and whatever, I've gone to some churches that I know that are more traditional, and they play these hymns, and actually they're really slow, or they're really like bogged down, and they just feel like really like they're not moving. And I know like those hymns, some of these hymns were written to be played fast, and they were written to be played like a bar song, like a happy, upbeat bluegrass style song.
It's funny you say written like bar style, because that is that I've read that during my research, is that they were written to feel like they came out of the pub or the bar, and had the energy to back it to keep it up.
Yeah, exactly. And so they were written in a time where that's what people were looking for. And now it's almost funny, because now they've become so churchy that the church has like slowed them down, made them a little more somber, a little bit more, which is interesting, because they weren't written to be that way. They were written to be up tempo, you know, fast, happy, whatever. My dad, he was a worship pastor at one point, and he was in a more, at the time, he was a very progressive guy in a more traditional setting, right? And so it was the early, you know, late 80s, early 90s, and the church was going through a lot of changes with worship as a whole. The whole church was starting all this new stuff. He had like a, you know, he had a drummer. That was crazy in the late 80s, like, you know, having a drummer on stage and whatever. And it was funny, because even then he was doing music and doing this newer style, and people would be like, you know, couldn't figure out, why are you speeding up old hymns? Why are you speeding? And he's like, this is the way it was written to be. Don't think that I'm not changing. I'm actually going back to what it was, the way it was written. And so there's a big difference. There's a lot of things. I mean, he was really good at what he did with that, but he made some big changes even in the church music at that time. One of the big changes that happened, hymns were written, in really four lines and simple stanzas. So it was like you just repeated the same little melody over and over again, you know, and it just kind of the same refrain. And it was very easy to pick up on in some ways, which is good, but it was very simple the way they were written. And so you would have these four verses usually. You usually have one verse about, you know, the beginning of things and the mess you're in. Second verse would be a little bit more about some hope that you were finding. Third verse would be about the life change that you had with Jesus. And the fourth verse would be about when you get to heaven someday. All the hymns had this structure that kind of worked out that way. And so he was doing hymns like that for a while. And he came back to our church the one year, and he was on an editorial committee for hymnals. If you remember hymnals, there were these books that had hymns in them, and everybody read out of the book. again, this is kind of an enlightenment thing right here. Okay, so everybody had a book, you read on pages, you had these notes, and suddenly everybody could read the same information, and everything was very laid out. In fact, the Enlightenment changed a lot of these things for us. That's where hymns kind of, the beginning of that situation came from, was these hymns coming out of the Enlightenment. In fact, that's why we like them so linear and so put together in such straight lines, is because the Enlightenment was all about that, right? The printing press was new, and suddenly we had lines that were straight lines of information. That's actually where pews came from, to be honest. The church used to be in the round, but the church started setting itself up with a pastor on a stage in the front, and then a whole bunch of lines of pews, and you could physically almost see, it's just like a typewriter. It's like lines of people sitting in rows, just like what we're
seeing. That's interesting. I've never heard that concept before.
Yeah, and it was all coming from that. And so you had these preachers like Jonathan Edwards, these different preachers at the time, they were preaching really heady doctrinal stuff, like really heavy stuff. I mean, the preaching was brutal. I mean, it was 2-3 hours long. It was so informational. It was very difficult to understand, to, you know,
comprehend, take in.
And it was like a thesis every time he would preach. But he was a big dog in that.
And that was traditional music going on during that time?
Yeah, that was when hymns started, and they had to find a way to get this huge doctrinal information in straight lines, very linear, very put together, 4 stanzas, 4 verses. Put all that together, and that's how we're going to disseminate the information to people. And that's where hymns came from. And I remember in the early 90s when my dad was on this editorial committee for these hymnals, he came back to our church, and he told them, he said, this is the last set of hymnals we buy. And they were like, what do you mean? And he said, this is it. This is the last set we buy. And the church was almost like, we have to keep buying hymnals. Like, we're not writing any more songs. We're not putting out any more hymnals. What's happening? And he said, no, I think that soon people are going to be reading words on screens. And so I don't think we need to have hymnals anymore. And the church like laughed at him. And then they never bought any more hymnals, because sure enough, there were words on screens. People were looking up, and they were starting to change the way that they were doing worship, right? Now you read words on screens. That's how you do things in churches. That's how you do things in songs. Like, it's PowerPoint, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Is you're looking at words on screens. And it's changed. And we can talk about that more, you know, next time. But that has changed significantly, the hymns, to where we are now in church music and how much that's changed.
Do you think your congregation would be open to an instrumental version of the hymns? Do you think you could create the same thing you're doing now, but if it was in an instrumental side and not so much traditional, where you just had an organ, but if you had a full band doing an instrumental set, forcing people not to hear any words coming in, but just to take a moment, sit back, and ponder their own thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea, and I think that there's
like a snarky puppy, or you know, something that's intricate, something that has. Yeah. Has a lot of meaning and very impactful and good energy, and like I'm thinking Miles Davis, where you sit back and you hear the instruments and you're like, okay, wow,
your brain starts
moving, start really.
I think there's room for that, and I think actually one of the things I have seen some churches that have done a really good job of blending these two, and in some level the church music is doing this. So some level they are taking some of the old hymns. They're kind of revamping them and saying, let's sing the same words. Let's sing the same truths that we've sung before, and the same, you know, the same powerful words that we've had for years. Some of us grew up with these words. Some of us found these powerful for years and years and years. Let's make them sound a little more new. You know what I mean? Like, so they are adding bands to that, instruments to that, more modern sounds underneath that. And that's working out well. A lot of times they'll add a bridge or another verse to it or whatever, and it works out well. Now, I also know some churches that have completely used only hymns, but they do hymns. Essentially, it sounds like Death Cab for Cutie is playing hymns. Like, it's like very indie rock sounding. They only use hymns, but they don't sound anything like the hymns you've ever heard before. So the words are the same. The melody stays the same a lot of times, but the instruments underneath it sound nothing like it. And there are a few bands that have done that, and there's a few bands that continue to do that. I know a few churches that's all they did, and they were growing like crazy in the postmodern and really Gen X demographics. They were seeing millennials through Gen X start coming through their doors like crazy off of this worship that was this thing that was such a bizarre mashup of the two worlds. And it worked. It worked fabulously. But they were very talented musicians, had a very unique way of doing it. But it was cool.
Yeah. Maybe it's that metaphysical thought.
Yes. Yeah.
That something new to grab, mm-hmm. to get a hold of, and something new to connect to that it's drastically different. Mm-hmm. Do you have you experimented with the lyrics of hymns, and I hate to add marketing into religion, but which religion is hugely based on marketing. Mm-hmm. Anytime you drive by a church, you see the sign, and they have great marketing, and I'm always thinking about it. But do you have you ever correlated? Have you ever tried to take a couple different hymns, tried them out, done the A/B testing to see what the congregation responds to better and what they're absorbing better?
That's a good question. I never have done a flat out A/B test, but I have done a lot of making sure that we integrated both. There was one church I worked at. We really found that we had some people that needed kind of both sides of that. And so we would, every service, we'd have a hymn in there. Now, again, we weren't doing it with piano and organ. It was going to be a little different than that. And we did find that worked out really well. I find that younger people are looking for hymns in their own way because the statistics are right now that a lot of people went to church when they were very young and have left the church. And now they're at an age where they like have their own kids, or they have something else in their own life where they're coming back to church a little bit. We're not seeing huge numbers of that, but we are seeing people come back to church. And when they come
I'm one of those. You could count me in as that number.
Yeah. And when you come back in, you kind of want something a little bit familiar. And so when you hear a song like, I'll just throw this out there, but like a How Great Thou Art, or
that
you're like, everybody knows this one. Like, or an Amazing Grace type of song. When you hear those songs, you're like, I at least remember a little bit of this, or identify with that. There was a song that we did. I remember there was a gal that was new to church, and we did a song that was an older Gaither song. It's called Because He Lives. Did this song in services at one point. And this gal, she was in her late 20s, had just started coming to the church. And I remember she was just bawling in tears. And she was like, my grandma, I stayed with my grandma for a long time, and she would always play that song on her record player. And she's like in tears. It was familiar. It still spoke to her. Now, we didn't do it like it was done originally necessarily, but we didn't change the melody. We kept that the same. We kept some pieces the same because it still had that effect that it still resonated with her. Does that make sense? So we still tried to keep those in the
rotation. Yes. What's your biggest challenge as not only the, the director of your church, but also as a musician at the church? What's the biggest challenge you and your band face?
Yeah, I think there's some interesting challenges, because I think there's always a tension, first of all, with your band, making sure that they understand like that we are always leading other people. So it's different than doing a concert. It's different than doing anything else. We're not there to perform for people. We're there to engage people and say, like, come with us, right? Like, let's do this together. And that's a big shift, because musicians, we're used to performing for people.
Performing.
Like, you you sit back and watch.
And the good ones can do both perform and engage.
Absolutely. I mean, like,
that is the key. If you can do both of those components, then you're going to be a wanted musician.
Exactly. And you're creating that experience. So like, I mean, like a few years ago, we went and saw Paul McCartney in concert, my wife and I, and we were at Safeco Field in Seattle. We're watching Paul McCartney do the first concert that's ever been done at Safeco Field where the Mariners play. And he comes out and, he does 3 hours by himself, just no opening act, just Paul McCartney being amazing. Like, guy 71, bouncing around the stage like he's a teenager, man. And he was incredible. And, there comes this moment where he does Hey Jude, right? And of course, that na 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 na. Oh my goodness, the room, I mean, this huge theater of people just freaking out and singing that at the top of their lungs for like 8 minutes. It's just super cool. And every person in that place has their own memory that they're attaching that to.
Oh, yeah.
Where they were, how that felt. What, you know, they're attaching that to something from them growing up or them being younger. But then there's also this new memory that's being made right now, right? Like, all these people are also like, but remember the time we saw Paul McCartney and sang Hey Jude with him? You know, and he kind of orchestrated this moment to be like, now it's your turn. Now you sing it. Right. And he backs away. And everybody does this in concert. At some point, you back away. I had a friend who calls it when the inmates take over the asylum. And he's like, let them, you know, let people sing that. Let them take their part and engage in this concert or in this experience. And it's the same thing with worship. There's a part where you orchestrate this moment where it's like, here's the things from the past. We add them to the things right now where there's a moment happening right in front of you. And then there's a part where we say, and now it's up to you because I've led you this far. Now it's up to you to take it from. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
that's what you hope for, actually.
It makes a lot of sense. One of the hardest parts about this podcast is pondering what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And because my brain's going a million miles right now, mm-hmm. and pondering what you're talking about and getting ready for the next question. But I have my next guest is he has his PhD in neuroscience. Mm-hmm. And when you were just talking about the Paul McCartney, in reliving a memory about the song, but at the same time creating a memory, what's the brain doing at the moment then?
Yeah, right.
Because that's intense right there. Because you've basically had this moment before. Mm-hmm. Because the song means that much to you that you instantly can recall the smell and all the feelings, mm-hmm. and everything about that, and now you're creating new memories with whoever you're with or wherever you're at. What's the brain? I'm going to have to ask him about it
because it's beyond my pay grade. But yeah, it's got to be like everything is coming together, right? Those are the moments where everything comes together.
That's intense. Do you? Are your band members as energetic and as excited as you are about entertaining engaging the congregation?
Yeah.
Do they share the same passion?
I think they understand it. I think, I mean, right now we have some newer people that we're trying to kind of get them to understand this a little bit more. But I mean, I've had people before that started out as like I had one guy, man, he was great guitarist, phenomenal guitarist. But I mean, he's an 80s shredder guitarist, right? Like you know, and he comes in and, you know, you had to be like, dude, the job is not to play like just solo over everything that's happening. Give it a break. There are moments for it where it's fine, but man, we got to give it a moment where you're not playing that, you know? And I think people have to learn some of that. You have to retrain yourself a little bit to get better at it. Because not everybody's going to understand how that works. So we've had to have people retrain themselves a little bit and think, again, this isn't about me. This isn't about my show. This is about how do I engage other people into this show? So sometimes you do things that aren't the best for you. Sometimes you key songs so that other people can sing them a little easier. Sometimes you change the melody so that it's more singable than what you like to do. Does that make sense? Sometimes you pull yourself back from how much you know you could do so that you allow other people into it. And next time, I mean, we can talk more about it, but there is a significant shift in what's happening in the culture with music and what happens like church music. So there was a day with church music, again, when they sang hymns. In the hymns, they would have every note on the page, and you would read the notes. You would actually sight read music on the staff and know these little shaped notes, where they go and how you're singing the song. And everybody knew how to do that, actually. A lot of people did. A lot of times you come into church and you could sight read a song.
Sight read.
Okay. But now, with music being cut in schools, with the lack of people's education in music that way, with the amount of like just even radio play and stuff, how do we learn songs now? We learn songs just by rote. We hear them over and over
again. Repetition.
Yeah, nobody ever wrote out you know, Roar by Katy Perry for me. And I learned it from reading shaped notes. I learned it because I heard the song a few times. It's super catchy. And suddenly I sing along with it, right?
That's how I learned the Frozen soundtrack.
Exactly.
Rhythmic repetition.
Then you don't even want to know. You know
because of that.
And that's the effect.
Yes, Sound of Music. Yes, these are the things that change you like the way you've learned music, and the church had to adapt to that, and it's changed that significantly. And it has changed. It's changed a lot of how we understand the music that we're interacting with. So that has other implications. it's not just about that we have, now we learn songs by simply reading words on a screen. Even though that's what we do. We see words on a screen and we just listen to the music and we read the words on the screen rhythmically until we get the song down, right? Which is different. That's a different change for everybody.
It is a huge change. I grew up in the Catholic Church and we had a chorus. We had an organ player, guitar player, and then we had the chorus. And my mom used to sing in the chorus and she always tried to get me to sing in the chorus. But I really didn't want anything to do with the church at all. I was young and on my own mission. But I remember the hymn books and I used to read them as well. Do you think you could implement a hymn workshop class? Do you think do you think any of that's relevant these days? Do you think people would get, because the research I conducted on this episode was a really good time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think I've emailed you a bunch of times. Hey, Kevin, there's this workshop on 1900, mm-hmm. Century jazz music. Do you want to take it? And you're like, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So do you think,
yeah.
Is there a way to get your? Is there a way to get people involved more than just sitting at the church and just looking at the projection screen and seeing? Could you get people involved back into the chorus side?
Yeah, I try to teach on it at our church a couple times a year. Make sure that I'm teaching our people what worship means and why we do it. But I also try to. I think there's some benefit to it. I think one of the things in the church you have to be really careful of, and I think you have to do this. With music and everything, you do have to say, here's the hymns, and here's why these matter in light of also where we're supposed to go now. Because the church was never designed to stay in a box. It was never designed to stay in the same place forever. It was designed to change and to evolve and to do new things all the time. So it's good to understand the history so that you can move into the future, right? And so that's part of why I think it'd be important is not necessarily to say, let's just talk about hymns and let's move back into hymns, but to say, let's understand the heritage we stand on so that we can move forward together into the next phase of whatever this looks like. Because there's also some songs right now that I guarantee you there will be songs that we sing right now that are not hymns, but they're newer. And I guarantee you my kids will go to a church when they're 25 and be like, why don't you guys sing the songs that I grew up with?
Yeah.
Just like the generation before is coming saying, where are the hymns that I used to sing when I was growing up? Just like the generation before them was frustrated with the hymns because they were like, hey, I don't like these hymns. I actually wanted, I like what we were doing before. So there's always going to be a change, and that's okay. The church was designed to be dynamic and change and continually become whatever the culture needed to be at the right times. And that's important. So I think if you're going to look at the past, you have to do it in light of, but here's where we're going to go with the future too.
I like that. We use hymns to teach, and it was the main reason why, so we could teach churchgoers. If you were to take a modern day artist right now, anyone who you're following or you like, what message would you like to see these people create in a song to try to get people to think outside the box?
Man, that's a good question. There are so many artists that I listen to that I'm like, they know exactly what they're saying. They may not understand it in the Christian context and I understand it, or in the church context and I understand it, but I hear their words and I'm like, oh man, like you're living, breathing exactly what we'd want to share with people right now.
Yeah.
When you hear, I don't know why I referenced her earlier, but when you hear like Katy Perry sing her song Wide Awake, and she's like, if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't give in, wouldn't bow down. She's talking about this idea of, if I knew then, if I had the wisdom then, what I knew now. Well, there's like an entire book called Proverbs in the Bible that talks about exactly that thing. You know what I mean? Or there's like obviously there's the bands that are easy to point to, the U2s, the Mumford and Sons, that they followed that track anyways. And it's easy to point to that. But I mean, man, I've always, again, as I mentioned before, like as a Dave Matthews fan, there were times where I'd be like, I wish this guy would write some music as a worship leader because man, he's incredible at this. He creates such an experience. That's such a unique experience when you're there.
Huge experience.
It's unbelievable. And one of the things I love about his style, and this is something that I love, is the evolution of his music, is if I take my song that I wrote in the studio, and you hear that song the first time, so you hear like you know, number 41. You hear a song that's like this, you know, 4 minute song that's supposed to be in a studio. It's very contained, very simple, and it's beautiful. It's well done, but it's just a simple studio song. The next time you hear him play it, he'll do it still pretty simply. It'll change a little bit, but he'll change just enough that it's a little different. It's a live experience. But the next time you hear him, the next year, 2 years later, whatever it is, all of a sudden that song's grown by about a minute or 2 minutes. And the next time it's grown by another 2 minutes or 3 minutes. And now it's a 20-minute song.
His songs morph into much more than where they started.
Yes.
I don't know if we've talked about this before, but Carrie and I are huge fans. Mm-hmm. We went out to the Gorge for our honeymoon to see him. Really? And three shows in a row. And we've gone every summer. Every summer we go see him in Tampa, and I've seen him quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And people ask me, don't you get bored of him? And I can't get bored of him. He just puts on such a fantastic show, and it's so different. And every time he adds a guest into it, and it brings a whole different element.
Yeah.
Whether it's Tim Reynolds or Warren Hayes coming in, just
and every time when he adds that layer to the music, the nice thing is I already know the song, right? Like, so I know the song you're playing, but now I'll follow you into the next part, and I'll follow you into the next part, I'll follow you into the next part because I knew the song, you know what I mean? And I think if hymns or church music could do that. I love the idea of that because you're taking those people with you through this journey of like, see, we did know this part, but we've changed it a little bit. It's still unique and it's evolving. It's becoming something bigger and something more impactful, which is really unique.
I think that's – okay, so I think you're on to something here because that's why people are so attractive to jam bands mm-hmm. and bands like Dave Matthews is because these fans who follow jam bass style – don't want to hear the same show. Mm-hmm. They don't want to see the same show. You go to a Grateful Dead show back in the day, mm-hmm. and then you went and saw them in San Francisco, and then you went down to Santa Monica mm-hmm. to see them at a show in Santa Monica. You were not seeing the same show. You were seeing two drastically different shows. And I think that is the selling factor. And I think if you can translate that into church music, because church music, from just my little research, it's growing, it's evolving, it's mm-hmm. always changing, and you have room to play around with it. Where if you're a cover band at the local Clearwater Beach Bar, you've got to stick to the Jimmy Buffett format, the Margaritaville, and stuff like that. But if you can implement some of those jam band tactics, and we can elaborate more on this in the off the record on the future. And I definitely want to have you back on the show because I covered one page of notes and I have about five other pages because there's lots and lots of stuff to talk mm-hmm. about church music.
A lot more.
Yeah. I appreciate you coming on the show and let's definitely make a date to come back on. Thanks, right. Kevin.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to episode 11 with Kevin Stamper. Our next guest is John C. O'Leary III, who created a solo piano album based on neuroscience. I am wicked excited to indulge into the creativity behind this album. If you have any comments or questions about any episodes, send us an email at cjsevents1@gmail.com. If you like what you hear, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Podomatic. I'm John Samuel, and of that, I'm sure, because nothing else in this music business is for sure.